Yeah, so what I have to do is basically make sure that this recording, that everything sounds good with your voice. So if you could just tell me what you had for lunch, and I'll make sure that the volume is okay.
I didn't eat lunch.
You're the second person today who said that. The nurses are too busy.
Yeah, well, usually I eat lunch, but I didn't today. I had to run to the post office.
If you get hungry in the interview, we can pause.
No.
I don't want you
I'm fine, okay. Really.
Just let me know. All right, everything looks good with this. I'm going to be trying not to, like, vocalize anything and say, when you're talking, just because it'll interrupt what you're saying. So I'll just be nodding instead.
Okay.
Just as a heads up. All right, we can get started. This is Maddie Kameny. It is June 26th, 2018. I'm at Conwell Health in Dunn, North Carolina, and I'm here with...
Lori Hinga.
Great. So we can get started?
Okay.
So I'm interested in hearing about how you got into nursing.
Well, I always wanted to be a nurse. That was my dream from a little girl. As a matter of fact, in the high school superlatives, they said that I would be a future nurse, and I was. But I started out in a RN program at, it was a Butterworth School of Nursing, which was a hospital program. And it used to be like a 3-year diploma program. Butterworth Hospital School of Nursing in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I started there, but I couldn't be away from home. And so I went back up to Northern Michigan University and just did a 2-year program there. So, but nursing, as a young girl, I always helped take care of my grandmother who was sick from an early age, and so I think that kind of prompted that career choice.
Can you talk more about what that experience was like?
Taking care of my grandmother? Well, sure. My mom was an only child, and so the responsibility to take care of, you know, her parents was all on her. But we had a great relationship. We were their only grandchildren, obviously. My grandfather was a wonderful caretaker of my grandmother who had had, she had diabetes and heart disease and very early on had a stroke. And so my grandfather, of course, she was young and he still worked. And so while he worked, my mom, you know, was a caretaker, my grandmother. But after she had a stroke, we had, they had a family cabin on a lake in upper Michigan. and they always had us kids spend the summer with them. And so I was very young, probably 8, 9, 10. I would spend the summer with my grandma and, you know, just keep an eye on her. And actually, after her stroke, she, you know, couldn't speak. And then she started to speak, but would, like, slur her words or they weren't comprehensible. And that summer, I remember saying to her, "No, Grandma, it's cereal," as if I was teaching her how to talk again. And so, you know, I remember that and then would just, you know, spend as much time with her. And she did gain her speech back. So that's how that all came about, our summers at the camp.
So how was that far away from where your parents were?
No. Actually, it was only about 7 miles. I grew up in a very small little town in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and there are a lot of small inland lakes there, wonderful for summertime. You can't really access them in the winter, but, and, you know, we would just go and stay with them.
Can you talk more about what it was like growing up?
growing up.
Or talk more about your parents.
Yeah, sure. Growing up in a small town, the advantage that we had, though, was that there was an Air Force base 5 miles away. And so we, you know, going to school and so on, we had kind of a large school for a small town because of the Air Force base. All the kids were bused there. So, but growing up, it was small town America, you know, and very much different than today. I mean, I had, you know, a close knit group of friends who were just the kids in the neighborhood, and we hung out, and we, you know, we were always like expected home for dinner at a certain time, and you know, if we weren't home, there wasn't cell phones, you know, mom would holler out the door, you know, it's time to come home for dinner or whatever. But we were very tight, you know, the kids in the neighborhood. And we had most of my summers I would spend out at our cottage with my, you know, grandma and grandpa. But also we had a river that kind of circled our town. And there were, like, swimming holes. And so in the summer we would do that. We all walked to school. Sometimes, you know, it was pretty far, but I'm really grateful for the growing up in a small town. I still have, you know, childhood friends there, and went to school from kindergarten through 12th grade with the same group of friends. And
what did you and your neighborhood friends do for fun?
Oh, well, it seemed we were always on our, you know, in the summer is when we could spend a bunch of time together. Otherwise, it was school and school activities. But we were always on our bikes. There was a park in town where we would go and play. Boy, I don't know. We did everything from Kool-Aid stands to... I don't know. I remember mostly one of the highlights was in the evening time. We would play like hide and go seek and kick the can. And
what's kick the can?
That it's like hide and go seek, except the safe zone is to come in and kick the can, and then they have to be it again, you know. It was just some crazy game we played, but...
Do you have any siblings?
I do. I'm the youngest of four, so I was the baby. And then I had a brother 4 years older than I, and we were actually born on the same day, 4 years apart, which was kind of cool. He never cared for me much because my mom had to go to the hospital during his fourth birthday party. And you never forgot that. And then I had a brother who was 18 months older than my first brother. And then my sister was the oldest. And she was 8 years older than me. So she was kind of bossy. She was kind of the leader of the pack. But yeah, there were all four of us.
Mm-hmm. What did your parents do?
Well, my father was a barber by trade, but in the 70s, when long hair came in and haircuts went out, life got really kind of tough for us financially. And so he pursued another job, working for the school system, driving the school bus. So he kept his barber shop, and he... it was unusual at the time, but he would set appointments for haircuts because he had, you know, everybody in town went to him for a haircut. So he would drive school bus, and then in between, you know, when the kids were in school or whatever, he would work at the barbershop. My dad was an excellent provider, and he He worked 12, 16-hour days most days. My mom stayed at home when we were young, and then she went to work as a bookkeeper for an oil company. And, you know, just to help make ends meet. But I mostly remember my mom being home. I mean, she worked when I was in junior high and high school, but for the most part, I remember her being home.
Mm-hmm. What about your, so you talked about the one set of grandparents that lived 7 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
What about the other set of grandparents?
Yes, that was my father's mother. She was... She was a very crabby old lady. That's how I remember her. She'd had a really hard life. She had only gone to school to the third grade. And she had to leave school to work in a boarding house, cleaning rooms and packing lunches for the miners. Because where I'm from, there's still iron ore, open pit iron ore mines, but there were also underground coal mines. And so her parents owned a boarding house, and so she had to quit school to work. And then she had three husbands, and they all passed away. And so she was just kind of a bitter old lady. I remember going to visit her, and she was an awesome cook, and but she was a perfectionist, and so kids in her house wasn't really what she preferred, I think. You know, that's what I remember about her. So we didn't have a very close relationship with her, but she did live to be 97 years old. And my dad was the youngest also of, let's see, 6 children. He had 3 brothers, and they all died alcohol-related deaths. So one was killed in the car accident, one died of DTs in jail. And so, you know, it was just a really hard life living through all of that. And he had 2 sisters who lived in the same small town, but they were a whole lot older than him. So there wasn't that real family connection there. So, I mean, we had cousins, and they would come in from out of town, and we would go to visit, but it wasn't, you know, a real connection or anything. Yeah.
What do you think, that, like, witnessing that with his brothers gave your dad, like, changed his perception of health? Or do you, like, how was his perception of that, having witnessed all of that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. He was very young when a lot of that happened. But I do think what it did with my dad did not drink alcohol. But I think it caused a little bit of maybe skepticism of the community and law enforcement, and you know, because it was hard for him to understand how that happened, especially his brother, who was actually jailed and, you know, and died. So as far as health goes, I think he kind of took it to an extreme. He didn't drink at all, which may have been a very good thing, although he had, I always said, dry alcohol tendencies. He still had some of the same personality traits, I think, of his brothers. Looking back now, being, you know, the age I am now, looking back on that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you have a sense of how your parents were raised in terms of health? health care and perceptions of health from their childhood?
Yeah. I think my mom probably had better experiences as far as healthcare goes. I'm not sure about how insurance necessarily worked back then, but I know that my grandfather always had access to healthcare because of the work that he did. And he made adequate income at that time, inadequate income to support, like, to pay for healthcare. So, on the other hand, I think my dad, didn't really receive, didn't really experience healthcare, or you did what you had to do, you know, to kind of get by. I think that was, I think, two totally different ends of the spectrum for my parents, maybe. But my dad did see healthcare as important. Even to this day, he'll say, "Oh, I'm so glad I," you know, because he ended up retiring from the school system. And when he retired, he got to leave with a retirement package where he had health care for the rest of his life. You know, he had insurance, and even supplemented his Medicare now. And he'll say, "Oh, I'm so thankful for that job. I don't know what I'd do if I didn't have coverage," you know. And what do people do who, you know, don't have any health care? And so at some point it became very important. I think that was one of the things. Also, he was self-employed without insurance. And he had children and a wife, you know. And like I said, he was a good provider. And so I think part of the reason that he chose to go to the school and drive school bus is for those benefits, so that he would have access.
So you think he has a different view of healthcare now than he did when you were growing up?
I think I know as a child and growing up, he didn't have access. But I think it became important to him. I don't know what that turning point was for him, but because I remember even when he took that job, you know, at the school, it was because there were benefits. You know, he wanted to be sure that he could, that us kids would have access to health care. So at some point it became very important. But even to this day, he sees that as, you know, important.
And what about for your mom?
Well, my mom passed away very young at 63 of ovarian cancer. And it was, that's typically a short-lived situation, because when they found it, it had already metastasized. But she, they were so grateful that my dad could provide or had worked to provide the care she needed. And she received the best of care. As much as you can do for that, you know?
Yeah, what was that experience like when she was going through that?
Well, it was really quite devastating because my dad retired quite young. I think my dad was like 55 or so when he retired. And they were going to, the cottage that I speak of was a small cottage. It had one bedroom. And it was an old log cabin, is what it was. And the plan was when Dad retired, they were going to take the... They were going to sell our family home, which was a very large, old, Victorian home. And they were going to sell that, and they were going to invest that money into the cottage and make the cottage a home. And they would stay at the lake in the summertime and then go to Florida in the wintertime. That was the plan. Well, my mom's diagnosis came as they were starting to plan the sale of their home. So it threw their plans kind of sideways, you know? And so I think just that change was hard for everybody, because we were excited for them. They had, you know, my dad had retired, and they were going to go and enjoy Florida and do their own thing and live at the lake in the summer, and that wasn't to be. But they ended up, they did sell their home. They did reconstruct the cottage at the lake and made it like a small two-bedroom home with modern amenities, you know. But my mom was sick through all that. And they did go to Florida for two winters. And she, of course, received care there, which was nice because she could, you know, they were insured and she could receive care wherever she was. But it wasn't, you know, wasn't what was planned. And so I think she still got to do what she wanted, but the hard part was that she was so young, and I was quite young at that time. And I had not only a mother-daughter relationship with my mom, but we were best friends. I talked to her every day. I really leaned on her, and kind of the roles reversed when she got sick. Some diagnoses or some diseases, there's just, you know, it is what it is. And so she ended up with like 3 years. But the one thing I remember about that whole situation is I became her caregiver, and as things work out just the way they're supposed to, I was working for a home health agency at that time. And it was for the county had a home health, and they pulled home health out of the county health department. It was connected with the health department, and they privatized home health. And when that happened, I got laid off. The only time in my whole entire career as a nurse being laid off was unheard of, but that's what happened. I got laid off in April, and my mom became increasingly sick. So what that did was it allowed me to take care of her. So I was her daily caregiver. My dad was still, he had retired, but he was working for my brother who owned a business. And my dad was not a very good caregiver. And so he went to work, and I took care of my mom. And my youngest daughter was like 5 then, so she was old enough to go with me, and I would take care of her, you know, which is really hard when you're a nurse and it's your parent. That was in April I got laid off, and my mom died July 6th of that year. And of course, hospice came in, and at one point, I just told the hospice nurse, "You know what? I can't do it anymore. I can't be your nurse." I didn't want to give her morphine because I was afraid it'd be the last dose, and I would think that I killed my mom or something, you know. It's like I had to separate. I wanted to be her daughter. Now I didn't want to be her nurse anymore. And so it was tough. It was tough. And I was, I guess 34, 35 at the time. And I had 3 children and it was tough. But I did get laid off and I did collect unemployment for that short period of time, which was really a gift, you know.
How did you get through that time?
I don't know. I look back. I think even though the cottage had changed, it was now a home, not a camp, so to speak. My childhood memories were so fond of being there with my grandmother and grandfather, and I don't know what I would have done without them. And that's where they were staying then when I was my mom's caregiver. So I think that helped me a lot. But it was hard. I mean, you know, I had a family of my own, a husband and 3 children, and it was really hard to balance, you know, that. And I have a real heart for folks who are like have to try to take care of parents or have parents living with them and still raising small kids. And I mean, my 2 other children were 9 and 10 years older than Emily, so they were 14 and 15. They could pretty much, you know, be on their own. But it was tough, and it was tough because my dad wasn't a caregiver, and so I felt that burden. It was just the balance. But I think that it was really good that I didn't have to maintain that full-time position of working. I don't know. I just look at that as a gift because I don't know how I would have done it. But
yeah. Do you think that taking care of your grandma and then your mom have kind of impacted the way that you go about your job?
Absolutely. Oh yeah, absolutely. One of my frustrations is that sometimes I think we forget about the patient. And I think that my career as a nurse and being a caregiver for my family members, I think that is always at my forefront. You know, don't forget about, you know, we talk about lots of things that are excellent in healthcare, population health management, which, you know, we have to navigate that way. But the point is don't lose sight of each individual person who falls into one of those health categories, you know. So I think sometimes I may frustrate people because I always want to bring it around to the patient, but I'm a caregiver. That was my goal, was to be a nurse. I didn't know that I would take care of grandparents and parents and a brother too, his whole life. But it impacted me in a profound way, yes.
How were you taking care of your brother?
My brother, he was 6 years older than me. He was an alcoholic and addict. And as bright as could be, intelligent, just misdirected issues. But anyway, I was his go-to, and we were very close. And at 27, he got endocarditis, which is an infection in your heart valve. And that was from dirty needles, shooting heroin. And so he was very sick for a very long time and was in the hospital for months because they couldn't identify his infection. Well, anyway, after that, he ended up having 5 open heart surgeries because the infection was so bad by the time they got it that they had to remove the valve completely, which was had never been done before, and it was done at the University of Michigan. So I guess, you know, talking to you, it's like, yeah, I took care of him too. And everywhere that, and I moved around a bit, and everywhere I went, he appeared, like he just, you know, and so I probably enabled him at times, but I understood, I tried to understand addiction, didn't condone it by any stretch of the imagination, but so, and with all of those surgeries and, you know, his health issues and medication, and I took care, I pretty much took care of him. He died at 53, which actually I think was a longer life than we thought he might have at 27, you know. But he was homeless in San Diego. He had a lifelong dream, and I think he knew that life was getting short for him. He was living with me and my family, and he wanted, his dream was to hitchhike from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan to California. That was in probably around 2006-07 time, which, you know, hitchhiking was not any longer something people did. It just wasn't safe. And so I helped him prepare for that trip, you know. And he was sober at the time when he left, and one of the hardest things I ever did was drop him off on the side of the road, and that's how he wanted it, and he wanted to go. And that was his dream. Anyway, he made it to Wisconsin, and he got drunk, and apparently lost the cell phone that he had, and we lost contact. And it was an interesting while, but he did eventually make it. He stayed at Yellowstone for a long time, and then finally made his way out to California. He did receive disability, and so he had a little bit of an income, and so he did have access to money. But when he got to California, I think his addiction was just too strong, and so he ended up living on the streets and probably, you know, buying drugs with his money. I don't know for sure, but pretty sure that's how it went. And then that's a very interesting story. I was working for the Medical Care Access Coalition, which was an organization where we provided health care to the uninsured through volunteerism. Our nurses, doctors, receptionists, everybody volunteered their time in our clinic, which was a fabulous experience for me. I spent 8 years there. But
Michigan?
Uh-huh, Northern Michigan. Yeah. But anyway, I got a call when I was working there, and it was the social worker at a hospital in California. She said, do you know my brother? And I said, yes, that's my brother. Well, the social worker, he came in, he was indigent. They knew this. And I say he chose to be homeless because our homes were all open to him, and he knew that. You know, but, you know, his addiction was just so far gone at that point. But anyway, what had happened was she had searched. He came in. He must have not been conscious And he came in, but he had a backpack. They grabbed his backpack, and she said she'd gone through his backpack 3 times and was looking for some contact information, didn't know his name, didn't know who he was, didn't know his family. She said the third time she went through the backpack, there appeared this piece of paper with my name on it, no phone number, address, nothing. So she Googled my name, and she found me at MCAC and called me and said that he was intubated and they couldn't get him extubated, and that they needed family to come there and make decisions for him. So my brother and I flew out there, and they did finally get him to come around and everything, and we begged him to come back with us back to Michigan, and he said no. So we set him up in a, I don't want to call it a hotel, but it was a room downtown San Diego where he had a bed and a commode and a sink and everything in a little tiny room. And we got him, you know, bedding, everything he needed, because he didn't have a thing. All he had when he went to the hospital was that, you know, backpack. And we got him all set up in there, and then we paid several months of rent, so to speak, for him, because he wouldn't come back with us. And that's where he died. I thought when he died, you know, that his heart had given out or something, you know, he just, because he was sick for so long, and he was really sick when we got there, and he was really skinny, and it was quite sad. But nevertheless, he had died in his room there, and nobody knew. And I could call him there through a switchboard, and I would call him, and for 2 days I couldn't reach him, and I thought, ah, darn it, he's out doing his thing again, you know. But they did, they found him, but and he had been dead. Well, then the autopsy came back, and it was amphetamine toxicity, so accidental overdose. And so that was really sad, and that was really hard for me, because even though he was there and I was here, you know, we were like connected at the heart. And 53 he died, so that was tough. But he also had the best of health care, he really did. I mean, he had Medicaid through the state of Michigan, obviously, because he had disability, but and he had, you know, he had great care too. So,
what were your experiences like with the healthcare providers when you went out to California when he had been taken in?
Well, you know, it's really, I think it was probably really difficult for them to care for him, because in the state he was in when he came in, they didn't know his history. I mean, you could look at his chest and see that, you know, by the scars that he had had several surgeries or whatever, but, you know, without a history. And they provided the care for him, but at some point, you know, you can't keep him in intensive care because they couldn't get him out of that, you know, that coma state, so to speak, which was medication induced, but then they couldn't get him out. And there is a certain medication which I knew and was well aware of that they needed to use to wake him up. And because otherwise when he would come out, he would be so combative, 10 people couldn't hold him down, you know, and so they'd put him back to sleep, so to speak. But I think that he, for the state he was in and the information they had, I mean, they kept him alive. And made sure he had all his medications and when we were still there when he was discharged from the hospital and sent him home with, you know, follow-up appointments and so on. So I think they did a great job, actually. Yeah.
Do you have any other negative or positive experiences with healthcare providers that you can remember?
No, I think it's really hard not to be critical sometimes of your profession, maybe. It's sort of like if you're a waiter, you know, you might be more critical in a restaurant situation. It's sort of that way with healthcare too, but honestly, I think the three loved ones in my life and being the caretaker for them, I feel like they got excellent care. Now, saying that, they were all insured, which I wholeheartedly believe makes a difference. My experience has been that it makes a huge difference in the care that you receive. Not maybe through individual providers. I don't know that it's a provider thing. I don't know that providers pay all that much attention to whether you're insured or not. They're going to take care of you because they're caretakers too. But when it comes to hospitalizations and medications and that kind of thing, and I learned so much about the struggles of the uninsured when I worked with the uninsured population. And, you know, the folks we worked with had to be denied by Medicaid. They were all really working at least a part-time job, trying to make ends meet, but certainly didn't have access to a group health plan or couldn't afford an individual premium. And so we really fought. I mean, our patients could get the 10 most commonly ordered labs. The hospital would donate those. And they could get basic x-rays and ultrasound through our program. And I mean, I think we secured probably $3 million in patient assistance program pharmaceuticals so our patients could get their medications. But without that program and before the Accountable Care Act, there was no access. There was no care for them at all. So I think I've seen really both ends of the spectrum, but my expertise really is process and performance improvement. And so I think there's always room for improvement. No matter what it is, there's room for improvement. And in 2018, there's a need for improvement in certain areas in order to stay alive financially. You know. But in saying that, I do think I guess I've seen the best and the worst as far as access to care. Now, the care itself, there's always room for improvement.
What made you come down from Michigan? Did you come directly here from?
Yeah, well,
yeah,
no. Well, yes and no. I moved here in 2014. My son is in the military, and he was stationed at Fort Bragg. And I still am consulting. And so I was working from home completely, and so I could live anywhere I wanted, and I wanted to be by my grandchildren. They have three children. And so I thought, yeah, I'm going to go. You know, I have the opportunity. And so I moved down to Hope Mills to be by my grandchildren. But then a year after I got here, my son got transferred, and I decided to stay. And I had several contracts when I was consulting. But one of the issues for me was that being self-employed, my healthcare premium was astronomical. It like tripled in 3 years, you know. It was horrible. And I just thought, you know what, I can't really do that. I can't do that. I'm going to have to go back to work, you know. And so that's when I started exploring the option of being employed for access to health care. So that's why. But I did move over this way, which is, you know, because I work here, and that was, you know, that was quite a drive. But
where do you live now? Is it a commute?
No, I live in just outside of Dunn. It's only 12 minutes for me to come to work, but I was driving an hour.
How has that been, that transition to such a different place? I mean, you said before we started, you said you've been here 4 years, right?
4 years, but three in Hope Mills, yeah, okay. Now here. This is hard for me. I'm from rural America, and I mean, there is absolutely, you know, my heart is in rural America, but it's very isolating here. It's very isolating. You know, things that you don't think about, like, you know, I used to be able to run an errand on my lunch hour, but you can't here. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just too far. And living in the country is really lonely for me, because I'm alone, you know, and it's hard. It's hard. You know, there's a lot of really great things about Kamwa Health, and I did a lot of research before I jumped ship, so to speak. But
can you describe a typical day at your job?
At my job?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm a project manager, and so I'm like a moving target. So a typical day at my job is multitasking, trying to, you know, I take a large project, of course, and then try to get the disciplines who are responsible to make certain things happen, to make them happen. And so I do a lot of that. But also, you know, some of my skills are performance improvement, and so I've been working a lot with collecting data and evaluating or analyzing that, and trying to come up with a plan for improvement where it's needed, and kind of helping to direct a little bit of quality improvement here. But I attend meetings in a day, typical day. I'm usually, you know, at my computer, returning emails, talking on the phone, attending meetings, sending reminders. I don't know, you know, it's a little bit of everything.
Yeah, yeah. What do you do to unwind and just kind of help you just care for yourself after the stress of?
That's just it, you know, that's just it. And that's a hard balance to reach. I think the older I get, the more I realize it. So I go home. I like to be busy. I have to always be busy. But I like to do crafts. I love to sew. I do those kind of things. I love to work in the yard. to me, that's, there's nothing more relaxing, or a garden. And where I live, I don't have a garden, but I did container garden. So I go home and visit my plants and talk to my vegetables.
Plants are great.
They are. Honestly, I think gardening is one of the most relaxing activities on earth. Now, I also go to the gym, but I've been limited because I've had a couple injuries. I think I get older, and I think I can still do what I did when I was 35 and not so much. But I also go to the gym, and I like to shop once in a while, but I don't like to shop like I used to.
Can you talk a little bit about your experience parenting?
Parenting?
Yeah.
Yes. No, I honestly, the difficulty in parenting for me was that, let me just say, I was a single parent most of my children's life, just this situation. So the difficulty for me was the balance of working and having a career, which was not optional. I mean, you know, you had to support your children. And so I think that was difficult. And honestly, I mean, I'm sure I'm very biased about my children, but being a single parent, I'm really blessed. You know, my kids never really gave me a run for the money, and they sure could have, because there was times when they had to be alone. I mean, there's only one of me. The biggest joys in parenting, though, I think, was I never missed a school program, a school conference, a football game. I never did. And a lot of that was while I was working at MCAC, and their family was really encouraged and important. And so we were allowed to leave for our kids' activities and so on and so forth. And I'm so grateful for that. My kids, I encourage them to stay really busy in school, because I believe since they were little, busy hands were happy hands, and they didn't have time to get into stuff. But I wasn't always there. But, you know, I loved being a parent. I have a super relationship with my kids to this day. Two of my girls are still up in Michigan. My son is in Virginia. He has had an exceptional military career. I love my son-in-laws. I love my daughter-in-law. I mean, it's just, I really feel blessed. I have two grandchildren now up in Michigan, though, that I didn't have when I moved to North Carolina. And that's a little hard, because they're little and I want to be there. But with FaceTime and technology, you know, we connect. But being a parent was a joy, and it was hard. It was tough sometimes. But, you know, I wasn't really a pushover either. I mean, my kids knew that. You know, they make fun of me now, but they're doing the same thing with their kids. You know, I'm a firm believer in accountability. And so that was one of the things, you know.
Yeah. What do you feel like you kind of took from your parents and applied either the same or differently to your own kids when you were raising them?
Well, let me throw this out there. I was raised by two perfectionist parents, okay? So, am I kind of type A? Not as much as I used to be. And seriously, I'm not as much as I used to be. But in saying that, you know, I think I took, you know, the organization, and that's really important in raising kids, although it was hard to balance because it was hard to, I mean, if my priorities were that the house had to be clean before we could go and do something fun, that wasn't okay. And looking back, I wouldn't do that again. But from my parents, I think accountability was really important. I think expectations, raising my kids and managing people, I always felt like if you set the expectation, they'll rise to it. If they don't know what your expectation is, they'll flounder. And I think I learned that from my parents too. I probably put it into practice a little different. But it was kind of tough because I was the baby, you know. So they had relaxed by the time they were raising me, and all of a sudden I had these kids, you know. And I mean, I think I was a decent mother, but I didn't probably have all the tools I should have had to. I was a young mom, and, well, 21, but, you know, young. So, yeah, but I do believe that no matter what, you know, I'll think, man, I just said what my mother said. Or, and I catch my girls doing the same thing now, you know. So, yeah, I think there's an influence. You say you're not going to be like them, and then you are. It's the way it is. I don't, you know, some of that stuff is just ingrained in you. And so as much as you don't want it to be that way, I was a much more liberal parent, I'm sure, than my folks. You know, my folks, here's one thing I can tell you. My folks always were worried about what everybody thought. You know, it was like, we don't want the neighbors to hear. We don't, you know, not even necessarily from a private standpoint, but more of a, well, we don't want anybody to think we have any flaws, because after all, they were perfectionists, you know, and they were. My mother sorted her buttons by size and color in baby food jars, and I am not lying to you. And my dad's tools were hung up, and if you didn't hang it up in the same spot after you used it, you were in trouble. And I mean, I had that coming both ways, right? Anyway, no matter what, you could fight it all you want, but
yeah. What about when your kids got sick? What kinds of things did you do?
You know, when my kids got sick, I was useless, because honestly, when I had to bring the kids for shots, my mom went with me because I couldn't stand to see my children get shots. Now, did I give children shots? Yes. Am I a nurse? Yes. But when it was my kids, it was different, and it was horrible for me. When my kids were sick, it was like when my mom was sick. I couldn't be a nurse then. I had to be a mom, you know, and it would just break my heart. They would cry, and I just would want to cry right along with them. It was horrible. And I realized that my little granddaughter has some medical challenges right now. She's 2, and I was recently up north first to attend some doctor's appointments with my daughter. This is my youngest daughter's daughter. And she just needs some support and really somebody to try to interpret what the specialists are saying. Because if you're a lay person, that can be really intimidating and really hard. That is one thing I will say. But anyway, I went, well, she had to have more blood drawn. No. Mm-mm. I wanted to be there to support my daughter, and I left the lab crying and left her there with Willow. So you know, it's just, it's that tender heart, and that's, you know, I come off probably more hard or strong, but I'm just a caretaker, you know, and to hear her cry was just too much for me. I couldn't do it, you know. So
do you remember when you were younger and you were sick or your siblings were sick, like what your parents would do?
Yeah, so I do remember. And you know, here's the thing, is we had a doctor in our little town. And for as long as I could remember, it was the same old, very old doctor, okay? You know what I mean? And so, but we didn't go to the doctor when we were sick. We didn't go, really, for certain things. But when we were sick, especially like if it was like the flu or a cold or something, you know, my mom would get out, she would cut up like old flannel nightgowns, and she would put Vicks vapor rub on her neck, and she'd put the flannel around it, and she'd pin it with a safety pin. And we weren't allowed like to be on the couch and watching TV. If you were sick, you were in bed, you know? And we would stay in bed, and she would like bring us soup and bring us popsicles or whatever it was, you know, that we needed. But I don't like remember my mom like taking my temperature or things that we do now. You know, the first thing if you call is what is their temperature, you know, or have you tried Tylenol or, you know, all those things. But I don't remember that. I mean, it was more like a homeopathic kind of, that my mom gave us fluids, I guess, but didn't really call it that.
Do you remember any other home remedies that she would use?
The Vicks was just, that was just always the highlight. Oh, and we would have a vaporizer, a hot air vaporizer, which was probably just throwing out more bacteria than we care to think about. But that's, you know, you'd get the vaporizer no matter what your ailment was. It was like you get the vaporizer.
Was it like an electronic?
Yeah, it was electric, but it like heated the water and then it vaporized it, and not like the cool air ones now. And it was just something else. I don't know that she gave us any special drinks or anything, but you could never get away with not being sick, because it wasn't really any fun to be homesick. You know what I mean? It wasn't fun in games like sometimes it is. Because she was very, you know, to the point. And, yeah.
Get better as soon as possible?
Yeah, we did too. We sure did. You didn't fake it. My brothers might have tried, because they were just like that, you know. But, well.
What is health to you, Lori?
Health to me?
Yeah.
Well, health to me is being responsible for your own physical health, having access to healthcare, not necessarily like top of the line or whatever, but to basic healthcare is health to me. And I think I guess I mean that's kind of loaded too, because it's like, well, health to me is managing your, you know, being responsible for healthy living, but having access to basic health care and required medications. But, you know, if you say, well, what is health care to you? I mean, I could list off a lot of things, but I think one of the things for me personally is having a relationship with a provider, maintaining that relationship, because I think that that's a two-way street. And then having the relationship and being allowed enough time to comprehend and understand whatever is being addressed. And having access to that provider if you need them. To me, I'm pretty simple. I mean, I do try to simplify things. I don't want to complicate things. But I just think my life experiences, more so in my professional life, has taught me a lot, a whole bunch. And I could go on and on about that. But I think that there's a lot of different stakeholders, maybe, who maybe direct healthcare or misdirect healthcare. and I think that causes a lot of disruption in the basic, simple, what do we need to do, what do we need to provide, and how do we need to do that for patients with such diverse needs and backgrounds, you know?
Is there anything, I mean, I don't want to take too much of your time, but if there's anything that you want to say about, like, what your experience has taught you, like, I know you said you had a lot, so...
Well, I mean, I did think about a few things, because, you know, reading this, and I love to tell my story, and we all have a story, and, you know, for the most part, I mean, I think that growing up, I grew up in a pretty healthy environment, and, you know, when, like, I got bit by a dog, that's when you went to the doctor, you know, when you needed stitches, right, or something like that. And I mean, and there's a lot of things that have directed my path, for sure, including being a cancer survivor myself of thyroid cancer, which most people say, well, if you're going to get cancer, you know, you should have thyroid cancer. Really? Have you ever had cancer? I don't think there's any good cancer. You know what I mean? So those kind of perceptions are a little off, and that's okay. I'm good. I'm golden. So have I experienced healthcare myself? Yes. But, you know, one of the things about health and healthcare is that it has been and continues to be directed in a large part by payment. And look, we all have to make a living, and we all have businesses to run and everything, but, you know, we went from like fee for service. So the more services we did, the more money we made, and whether they were necessary or not, right? I mean, so fee for service, and now we're we're gradually, you know, working in to pay for performance where, you know, well, show me some outcomes, you know, on certain disease conditions and then, you know, and then you deserve more money. But there's a lot of things that impact that too, because we have a shortage of primary care doctors, not just in North Carolina and Michigan, and in every state probably almost. So we're directing kind of healthcare by payment, but I don't know that we have all of the things in place for any of those payment systems. In other words, if we're gonna go to pay for performance, I'm all about that, because I'm all about data and I'm all about improvement and I'm all about that, and I'm all about diabetes and so on and so forth. The problem is it takes a lot of time to provide the care necessary to influence those outcomes. And so I feel like we're always chasing our tail, you know, we're always chasing our tail. Yeah, pay for performance and value-based payment is all very important. I don't doubt that, but how are we going to do that? You can't see 18 or 24 patients a day and provide the care necessary to influence positive outcomes. You know what I mean? So I always sort of feel like we're putting the cart before the horse. You know, they're all great ideas and they all have to happen, and I get all that, but are you going to give us like a million primary care doctors to provide this type of care? You know what I mean? So there's some gradual changes being made in healthcare just in my time. You know, we used to pay bonuses to providers for productivity. If you see 24 patients, you get this bonus. But if you only see 12, you get nothing, right? Well, that's not really great, because it didn't matter what kind of care you gave as long as you saw those patients. Sort of like fee for service, you know what I'm saying? So that didn't work. So now we're going to pay providers, and we're headed in this direction here at Comwell. And I was in 2010 up north. We paid our providers by quality of care. One of them being patient satisfaction and customer experience. You know, that's important. There's no question about that, and I'm all about that. And so to get them thinking in that value-based payment thing, you know, we paid them a bonus on quality. But that's a good move. But in order to do that, they have to have time with the patient, or you have to have other systems in place, and you got to have a whole healthcare team that's pitching in to see that that happens with the patients, you know. So one of my soapboxes is, you know, I'm all about value-based payment. I'm a quality person. I'm a process and systems thinker, and I know that. And I can put all the systems and processes in place and be the most efficient primary care clinic. But there still isn't enough time to see the percentage of patients that each provider needs to see in order to get everybody health care. So I think it's an uphill climb. I don't know what the answer is necessarily to this. And the Accountable Care Act is great. Trust me. I mean, I worked with the uninsured for 8 years, and our whole goal was to have health care for everybody. And that's what we have. the part we forgot in that was affordable health care for everybody. I mean, I made decent money consulting, don't get me wrong, but I still couldn't afford the price of the premium. You see what I mean? So, and even though there's subsidies, people, they either have to eat or they got to pay a healthcare premium, and they're going to eat. You know what I mean? So we haven't solved that problem yet. So we still have a lot of people that are uninsured. And do they have access? Not so much. Here they do at Commonwealth Health, because that's what a community health center does. But if they're uninsured and you try to get them to a specialist, see? So there's still some things that aren't, I think we're changing things, and change is good, and I'm all about change. I'm a project manager, you know. I'm not here to make friends, that's for sure. But the point is we have to think these things through, you know, before we try to implement them. We've got so many requirements, you know. You got patient-centered medical home, and you got meaningful use, and you got joint commission, and you got CMS, and you got HRSA, in order to meet those requirements, you know, you have to train and educate people, including providers. You know, providers go to medical school and they get a wonderful education as far as that goes, but all these other things, when they come out of medical school, they still have to learn that. And we can't, you know, we can't expect them to see 24 patients and provide valued services if they don't even have the basic concept of what it is, you know. So those are just some of my issues in healthcare. And here, the other thing I wanted to just share is, you know, here at Commonwealth Health, in a big way, but I think everywhere, you know, you heard the term social determinants of health, right? And being in public health, by the way, I worked with the Louisiana Public Health Institute for 3 years, man, I'll tell you what, that was an experience. I was just on their website today checking it out, see if they have anything new going on. But off the record, I'll tell you about that. But the social determinants of health. And so there are pockets where there are higher incidents of that, but we don't take any of that into consideration. And when you consider those social determinants, they influence disease and condition and literacy, addiction. I mean, there's so many things. Housing, just housing. So you have all those things, and none of that's taken into consideration for payment. You know what I mean? And so these are the things that I see, and I wish I had the answer. I don't, and we have to depend on the lawmakers. I just hope that they bring the right people to the table who can influence or who can share experience and say, whoa, wait up, back up that pony. What about this, you know? And maybe if we did that, nothing would ever happen. I don't know. But I feel really bad, because I think that as caregivers, whether it's a provider, a nurse, anybody who works in healthcare, period, and it doesn't even matter necessarily what influenced us and our generation, I think, but where do we get the time? How do we make it happen? Well, I impact that because I help them put efficient systems in place, as efficient as you can be. But no matter if you have the most efficient systems, you still have these other influencers that are hard to overcome. And I think when you talk about payment, you have to take some of that into consideration. That's just, it's just necessary. So, I mean, I could go on and on because I got lots of, I've been a nurse for 34 years, you know.
Not as much as you want.
So, I think I saw something, and, you know, and I had written down here more outreach. I really think that where we're at is sometimes we got to meet our patients where they're at. And I don't think population health management is a bad thing at all. I think it's a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful, and it's not cookie cutter. It's just a wonderful way to manage health. But in saying that, you know, there's additional steps, and that is, you know, you got to educate people. And do you have time in a 10-minute visit to provide the education that you need? But and outreach, what I mean is, if we go to our folks, especially in rural USA and where you have high numbers of social determinants of health, and we go meet them where they're at and provide education at their literacy, and that we remember, you know, we remember all that, regardless of payment. You know, I know we have to survive, and I get that, and we have to get paid for what we do, but so, for the most part, I've been involved in public health and community health centers, MCAC, I mean, that's where my heart lies, right? But, and it doesn't change the fact that you still have to get paid for your services. But I feel bad because I do think that all caregivers really want to provide the best that they can, but the limitations because of the requirements, you know, and you just can't provide what's needed. And I don't know, I'm not suggesting that they go away from value-based payment or pay for performance or anything. I mean, we need to do that, but then we have to have the time and resources to do it.
How was it when you were a patient? I mean, you can talk about cancer and talk about something else if you don't want to, but knowing so much about the system already, like all of that knowledge that you have, but then going through it on the other side as a patient.
Well, it's frustrating as a patient, because even as a patient and putting all that knowledge and everything else aside, I will say this, that I've had wonderful care, wonderful doctors and all of that, but I never felt like I had the time to ask the questions or to get the answers. I always feel, and even with my primary care provider, I love him to pieces. I drive to Hope Mills to see him because he was my provider there and I don't want to switch, because I think that much of them. But everybody has their hand on the door. They got to go. They got how many more patients to see today? And I really do, and I don't think that that's even a judgmental. I just think that that's how I feel, that I never, ever get enough time, no matter where it's at. You know what I mean? For instance, so I've had thyroid cancer, right? So you have to have an annual ultrasound of your head and neck. That's just standard. So my doc, Travis, ordered, he obviously wasn't thinking, right? And so he orders a thyroid ultrasound. Well, I don't have a thyroid, right? But you gotta, as a healthcare provider, you gotta think outside that box. So I go for my ultrasound, and the ultrasound tech's like, So we're doing a thyroid ultrasound today. And I said, not so much. Right? Now, and she said, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, I don't have a thyroid. Well, why are we doing a thyroid ultrasound? And I said, we're not doing a thyroid ultrasound. We're doing my annual head and neck ultrasound. Well, that's not what he ordered. Are you having any issues? And I said, well, actually, I am. I have, you know, this one node that they've been watching for 3 years, but it's important to get it measured. And I've been feeling something under here that Travis was concerned about, you know. And so, and she goes, well, where are they at? And I said, well, right here and right here, you know. She ultrasound those. She didn't do a thyroid ultrasound. She didn't do a head and neck ultrasound. Doesn't do any good for you to do that, what's already there. You can come in, what's there, and not, come on in, I'm just chit-chatting. And not do what's necessary and not be able to problem solve that, you know what I mean? So first of all, it was really a waste of my time, you know what I mean? And that was frustrating because I knew what he wanted, she knew what he wanted. All she had to do was call to say, you know, you ordered a thyroid, but the patient's here, and you know, but wouldn't do that. And so again, you know, I didn't get what I needed. That time. You see what I mean? So it's like
simplification thing you were talking about.
It's not hard, but you know what I mean? And it's that was not efficient. And it started, you know, with my provider. And did he write thyroid ultrasound because he was in a hurry? But what that did was, you know, it caused a hiccup for everybody. And so we didn't get back what he needed. I didn't get my annual. You know what I'm saying? And I'm just using that for an example. I don't think I'm being overcritical of that. But the problem is I'm a nurse and I've taken responsibility for my health care. And I tell him when it's time for my annual neck. And, you know, because that's my responsibility, I feel, you know. But wonder if I'm a layperson. Wonder if I'm somebody who doesn't understand that. And I show up and they say they're going to do a thyroid ultrasound. And I say, yeah. And they look at it and there's like no thyroid there. You know what I mean? So I don't know why that is. I don't know if that's because everybody's in a big hurry. And I feel that. I feel that. When I see my provider who I love, you know, is he still in a hurry? Slow down, you know, but you can't slow down.
Right.
Because you got to see these patients. You got, and he's independent. So he probably doesn't have a quota of patients to see, you know, but we're short on primary care providers, and so there's a lot of patients. And now a lot of patients do have insurance. And so they feel like they can go to the doctor, and they should, you know? But I don't know that we looked at all that as public health officials, you know what I mean?
What do you think about bringing, like there's a lot of talk about bringing more PCPs to rural areas and like incentivizing people, and like have you seen any of that firsthand and have any opinions about it?
Because I've worked with a lot of FQHCs, and of course they have that repayment program for providers. But I mean, you can turn this off. You probably don't need all this, but
if you're okay with it being,
I think incentives are an excellent way to bring providers, especially to rural areas. The question, though, is even if we incentivize, is there still enough? I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I don't know, you know, what it's going to take. I mean, we use a lot of mid-levels, and that's okay. I'm a firm believer in that. But I think one of the missing links is that we talk about care teams, but we don't really function in care teams. And I don't mean just Commonwealth Health. Look, I worked with a whole bunch of FQHCs up and down the Gulf Coast when I was with LPHI. And it's universal, pretty much, that we don't understand what a care team is and how it's supposed to work and how it can benefit us because we don't have time to stop. This is the way we've done it. This is where we're comfortable. This is how we're going to continue to do it because we got to get it done. And we don't take that step back and try to understand it or bring people in who can help you understand it because I think that's the only answer to the whole thing is that every discipline is functioning at the top of their skill level. And if you can't function at the top of your skill level, then you need to get retrained. You know? Seriously. Because there isn't time. We got people's lives we're talking about here. This isn't, you know what I mean? And a provider cannot do it alone. Whether they think they can or try to do it, it's just... You can't do it. The requirements that are set now for payment, etc., require a care team approach. It's the only way to get it done. And even then, you'll have your hand on the door because we don't have enough care team members. But, you know, it's hard. It's really hard. I think that we have to continue to be innovative and we have to continue to think outside the box on how can we make this happen for our patients. At this point, we have to focus on our population of patients. You know, I could go on and on. You can go into population health. You better be looking at your provider panels. You know, you got to be looking at those panels because if you have one provider with 3,000 patients and one with 1,500, you know, and the one with 3,000, a third of those are diabetic patients. No, they can't take care of that many. I mean, just the math and data tells you they can't care for them. I don't care how great a care team you have. That's impossible. But I'm not sure, especially in primary care, that we understand all that yet. I'm not sure we understand it. And we're taking care of sicker and sicker patients and more patients with less and less providers. So we all have great intentions. We're all caregivers. We all really care about patients, you know, but I don't know that we're doing the best we can.
That's the battle.
Hmm?
That's the battle. I'm really glad that you're here fighting it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and it's hard. I mean, people don't like change. They don't like change, but we have to change. Because you're not going to get paid. The bottom line is this. You're not going to get paid if you continue to provide care the way you always have. Because it just doesn't work that way. I don't care if you're Atlas. You can't do it. It's impossible. The numbers tell you that. So you have to get creative and innovative, and you got to be open to change. And you know, technology is our friend, and technology has come a huge long way. I mean, I think about those paper charts. I mean, now paper makes me nuts. I can't if I, you know, and some of my clinics, you know, the problem is that came in like a firestorm. This is life according to Lori. But EHRs came in like a firestorm, and we didn't know what we didn't know. We didn't know what we needed. We didn't know. Nobody did. And we didn't bring in people who could help us know what we didn't know. And so we all ended up with these fabulous systems, but we don't know how to work them. And we didn't build them because we didn't know we had to build them. I mean, I could go on that. But the point I'm making is we've had these EHRs long enough, but what people have done is when they didn't know what they didn't know, then they made workarounds to all of the technology. And even at my doctor's office, and I told my provider this, and he knows me, and he knows what I do for a living, he knows, but he'll come in, he doesn't even have his laptop with him. I said, Travis, where's your laptop? What do you mean, where's my laptop? I said, well, don't you have an EHR? And I know he does. Well, yeah, I got an EHR, but I can't haul that thing around with me. I said, Travis, what you're doing is really inefficient. I'm just saying, we're not using that either. We're writing stuff down on paper, right? Then we're going to go. Then we're going to transfer it in. Number one, the chance of error when you use electronics and paper, I mean, your error rate goes like through the ceiling, right? Not only that, but the time involved in doing that. That's what I mean. Like, we have all these inefficient systems, Maddie, because we didn't know what we didn't know, and we didn't have time now to ask the questions or figure it out. Maybe we didn't buy the maintenance package so they'll help us figure it out. So we just go back and do what we were doing. We grab a sheet of paper and we write the vital signs on a piece of scrap paper. Come on. You know? And then we wonder, we're short on providers, right? We got all these patients to see, and we're going to have inefficient systems on top of it. You see what I mean? I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
So I've had a lot of experience. You don't even know how grateful I am to have had it and to experience what I've experienced in my career. I think it's a battle we have to continue. I think incentives in rural areas is an exceptional idea. But, you know, I was thinking, if there was one thing that would have the biggest impact or the biggest influence on primary care. Now, I can only talk to primary care because, I mean, I directed quality in a hospital and blah, 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 but that wasn't my forte. My forte is right here. What would that be? What would that one thing be that would be the priority? You know, because I've talked about lots of things. But, you know, I think if all was said and done, what's really lacking is the training and education we need. The people, you know, you can't just put out initiatives with how-to manuals because people don't have time to sit and read it and figure it out. You know what I mean? And I think if we're going to change a lot of things or hold primary care accountable to certain initiatives, I think that's a good thing. And I'm all about change, but we got to make sure that people, well, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. So what I'm saying is you have to make the training and education available for them, because the electronic health record, like, we incentivize that in a big way through meaningful use. I mean, but the problem with it was this: nobody knew what they needed and how to get there. They didn't even know the word workflow, right? And so what are they doing now? Now what they're doing is they're replacing all their electronic health records because they couldn't figure it out and they didn't know how to build it. So they're spending millions more on a new one, and they're going to have the same issue. You know what I mean? And that's going on all over. That was happening down in along the Gulf Coast. You know what I mean? Because, or we're just going to go back and make workarounds and use paper and walk in the room without your the record. I said to Travis, would you have come to see me without the paper chart? No. Then where's your laptop? You see what I mean? They do the same thing here. Drives me bananas. I don't have any influence over that. But I'm just saying. So to me, in a nutshell, and I'll finish with this, there are very simple things that could be done to help streamline primary care. Simple things. A little robust training when before initiatives would be super. And maybe even getting more folks to study medicine with a focus on primary care. You know, they all want to be specialists because there's a lot more money and a lot less call time. Anyway, I could go on. I've got a 34-year career.
You're a wealth of knowledge. You it's know, been a great
time. But I want to tell people, you know, and I loved being at Louisiana Public Health Institute. And honestly, I thought about moving down there and working with them. I don't have an MPH, obviously, and that's probably what you're working toward, huh? But they loved me anyway, because I was just a little different. But they do such great work. Some of the projects we worked on were incredible. What an incredible opportunity I had. Now, at a point I thought, well, I could live in New Orleans, you know? I could just get one of them apartments above and enjoy this nonsense for a while. But I don't know if I could do it really, truly. I was consulting with them, so I would go down every 4 to 6 weeks, you know, and it was fabulous. It was the best of both worlds, but I don't know if I could live in New Orleans. And I know there's other public health institutes, but
yeah, much different than here.
That's a great place. I'm just throwing out a plug for you. Where are you from? Here?
I'm actually from, well, we can turn this off.
Yeah, turn it off.
All right.
I always want to know.